Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
As we continue to study from the book of Romans and in this marvelous 12th chapter, as we have mentioned several times before, the book of Romans presents to us the system of salvation that God has designed, gradually unfolded, delivered unto mankind. Now, thus far, we have learned that there are a number of essential components that make up this entire system. Salvation is not by anything alone. When people talk about salvation by faith alone, or grace alone, or anything else alone, they're missing the mark. We are saved by the grace of God. We are saved by the mercy of God. We are saved because of the love of God. We are saved by Jesus Christ. We are saved by His blood and by His sacrifice and His resurrection from the dead. And those are the things that deity has done on the behalf of man. That's God's part in God's scheme of redeeming man. Man also has a part. He must have a faith, but a particular kind of faith, and that is an obedient faith, and that which he must obey is that which is the law of the Spirit of life, the law of Christ, the way of the gospel. Now, there is something else about the system of salvation that we who are Christians don't want to ever forget nor dare minimize. There is, of course, that which God has done and that which we must do to enter into the benefits of this system. But having once become a Christian, God expects us to be what we have become. And the book of Romans teaches us how to be what He expects. It tells us what we ought to be and how we can accomplish that. There are certain characteristics there are to belong to those who are the disciples of Jesus Christ. And of course, these marvelous characteristics, the Apostle Peter talks about being partakers of the divine nature, characteristics that were like that of Christ. But the book of Romans, along with all these other things, emphasizes the necessity of a Christ-like life and faithfulness to keep on keeping on in that manner of life. And so when we come to the book of Romans, it really doesn't shift gears on the major theme of God's way of saving man. It's talking about another element involved in this system, and that is what we so frequently refer to as Christian living. Now, we briefly looked at the first two verses last time, and I'll just read these, and then we'll go on into the other verses. Paul said, "I beseech ye therefore, brethren," he is literally begging them, pleading with them, "by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable or spiritual service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed," changed in other words. How? "By the renewing of your mind." It is an inward change that manifests itself in an outward behavior. "By the renewing of your mind, that you may prove," you put to the test, you will demonstrate, you will display in your own life what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And then he goes on to elaborate into a number of specific things that we are to display in life. And when I use that word display, I simply mean characteristics by which we are to be known and our lives are to follow. We don't put on a show. It's not some sort of outward piety to gain us some kind of notoriety. But we are to demonstrate, not only talk, as James says, don't be just hearers, but doers. We are to demonstrate what the will of God is. So in verse 3, he says, "For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith." Now, when Paul says that he is saying what he is saying through the grace given unto him, you have to keep in mind, as you go back into the earlier part of the book, this grace to which he's referring to is the fact that God had called him to be an apostle. And as an apostle, he was an inspired man. This is Paul's way at this point of saying, "I'm telling you now, by inspiration, here is something that you ought to do and ought not to do. Don't think too highly of yourself." Now, he is not condemning the possession of self-respect. We ought to have self-respect. He is not exploding the idea or the goodness and the value of having self-esteem. People that do not think well of themselves are the kind of people who will do most anything because they have come to the conclusion they don't care, they don't count, they don't matter, therefore what they do doesn't count and doesn't matter. And I think that this certainly is the contributing factor to some of the malbehavior that we see in society today. People have not learned to respect themselves enough to behave themselves. People who have a certain amount of self-respect are going to try to conduct themselves in a self-disciplined manner. You don't have that kind of respect. Who cares what I do? Who cares what I say? I don't care what I do. I don't care what I say. And then the devil gets your life and you live like he would have you to live. But there's also a danger that you can develop an inflated ego. You can develop a sinful pride to where you think you are something that you aren't. And Paul is warning here, don't think too highly of yourself. And he's going on further in the chapter. We'll get to it. Well, we'll just wait till we get to it. He brings this up in another fashion a little bit further in this chapter. Being heady and high-minded is not Christ-like. If there was anything that characterized our Savior, it was a genuine humility. And he humbled himself even to the point that he took on the form of a man, came down here and lived among men, leading heaven itself. So he's warning us, don't be a stuffed shirt. Don't stick your nose up in the air. Don't be a snob. Don't be an egotist. Don't think too much about yourself, because those who think so highly of themselves are going to ignore their responsibilities and duties to other people and just run roughshod over them for their own selfish ambitions. Rather than doing that, think soberly. What do you think that means, to think soberly? Anybody? Now, it doesn't mean just think without being drunk. That's, I'm sure that would be sober thinking, all right. But what does he mean here, think soberly? That would be one way. What else? If you do something soberly, serious, with meditation, with thought, beg pardon? With a sound mind, all right? In other words, not a flighty, flippant kind of evaluation of things. The faith, the religion, the standard, the teaching of Jesus Christ. There's your measure. That's the way we're to measure our thinking. That's the way we're to measure ourselves. Godly thinking, all right? Okay. Yes, arrogance is very closely associated with this thinking so highly. That just think the whole world must necessarily orbit around them. And that everybody else lives in order to accommodate them, and everything that is done is supposed to suit them, and they're just saturated with self-centeredness. Like I said, you just read about people like that. You've never run into. Now let's look at verse 4. Here's one of the reasons that we're not to exalt self. For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, that's we Christians, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. Now here's one of these real glorious analogies that the Lord here has presented to us through Paul, describing His people. We understand somewhat of the functions of a body. We know that a body has many different members. We know those members working together accomplish what the body is supposed to accomplish. And there is a unity and a oneness, and together there is a completeness. Something is wrong if this member over here begins to inflict injury on another member. You'd think something is just a little bit out of kilter here if a man starts stomping with one foot his other foot. Now, he may have a bad athlete's foot, but we're putting that aside. He just starts abusing that, kicking himself harshly in the shins, taking his fist and bloodying his own nose. Saw a fellow do that one time, but he didn't intend to. He had a screwdriver and it slipped. But I got over it. But now, I knew right away something was wrong. That wasn't the way the body was supposed to work. A body here is presented as something that with different talents, different abilities, and he goes right into that in the very next verse, working together. What a marvelous manner of presenting the oneness that we have together in Christ. And brethren, this oneness teaches us several things. It makes a difference to me what you do. And it makes a difference to you and affects you what I do. Therefore, this forever explodes the idea when what I do is my business. There's nobody else's business at all what I do. But that's not right when you're a member of the body. What if the hands came along here and says, now it's none other part of the business of the body what I do. If I want to get infected, I'll just get infected. If I want to beat up on you, I'll just beat up on you. If I want to burn myself, I'll just burn myself. It doesn't affect anything else but me. Well, it affects the entire body, doesn't it? You just let one part of the body become diseased or ill, and the whole body sometimes reacts with fever, doesn't it? And brethren, it makes a difference to everybody else in the church how I live. It makes a difference to everybody else in the church how you live. And this is the reason we look out for one another, the reason we have a right to look out for one another. It's the reason we have the obligation to look out for one another, because we're all in the same body. And then drawing further from that analogy of the body and many members, he begins to point out the different members have different functions. Verse 6, having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given unto us, for the prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith. Now, prophecy here, let me ask you, what do you probably immediately first think of when you think of prophecy? Somebody. Reading the future. That's what nearly everybody thinks of first. Do you know that's not the primary thrust of prophecy? The primary thrust of prophecy is to teach. Now, the Old Testament prophets, for instance, there were many things about which they foretold and predicted the future, things that were to come. But most of their work was preaching God's will to the people of their time. Not all of it, but a huge portion of it. Now, here is one that has the capacity to teach. Here's one that has the capacity to reveal truth. Maybe he has the gift. Here it might have even been a miraculous gift of revelation. Here he has the ability to preach the gospel. Well, then let him do it. Let him do it according to his faith, the proportion of faith. He has this faith. He has this conviction. He has the knowledge of the faith. Then get to it. And then he goes on to the next one, or ministry. What do we mean by ministry? Serving. Got to be by the according to the word of different things even from that. Now, in ministry, let us wait on our ministry. Let's tend to it. Let's give ourselves to it. The capacity that we might have to serve, do it. Or he that teacheth on his teaching. Where's your talent? Where's your ability? Where's your opportunity? Then he's motivating us, encouraging us. Then be busy about the Father's business. Or he that exhorteth. What does it mean to exhort? Encourage? Exactly. Strengthen? Edify? Build up? You know there are just some people that seem to have an exceptional talent of arousing interest and enthusiasm and encouraging people. And somebody's sitting right out there too, because I've heard you do it. You're just, somewhere or another, have either developed equality and ability to just get people to want to do. Now, with that kind of ability, to he that exhorteth on exhortation. Concentrate on that talent. Now, let's get a point here. It doesn't mean that you've just got one talent and you don't have any of the other or any of the other. You may have a little bit of all of them. But whatever talent, whatever ability, whatever gift, whatever opportunity that you have, Paul is saying now, it takes everybody. Everybody in the body doing everything they're supposed to be. Or he that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. Now, this word simplicity is probably more easily understood. Let him do it in abundance, or let him do it with a liberal, cheerful willingness behind what he is doing. Some can give more than others. And I'm not just talking about finances. Some can give more time than others. Some folks even have more energy than others. But each one that has his whatever talent is, be at it. He that ruleth. Now I wonder who in the world that could be referring to. Don't be afraid. Who is it? Elders, that's exactly right. Who you think has the rule of the flock? Elder of the church, with diligence. What does it mean to be diligent? Well, my daddy used to say that means you got a lot of sickle. You got a lot of get up. Straightforward. Tending to it. Attentiveness.
No compromise.
No compromising. Well said. Exactly. And then he goes on to say next, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. There are so many people in the world who need a merciful attendant. They need somebody to listen, somebody to sympathize, somebody that will console. It's difficult to hear folks that are burdened with things. And a talent, you ought to use it, and you will be a blessing to those round about you. And if you're the kind of person that can listen to other people's problems, but it doesn't say if he can't work, it said if he won't. But you know, it takes everybody. Now that's what he's talking about. It takes everybody in the body. You may have the capacity to do one of these things better than others or the next one with us. But if you'll do what you can do, and the next will do what he can do, and the next will do what he can do, that makes the body function, doesn't it? That's what he's talking about. And because, well, when Paul was talking about the same analogy in writing to the Corinthians, the hand not to say to the foot, I have no need of you. The eye can't say to the ear, I have no need of you. We're not to think too highly of ourselves. Everybody has need of everybody else. Now let's look as he goes on here and talks about another characteristic. Let love be without dissimulation. Now love, here, the word agape, the word is seeking the other's highest good. And this word dissimulation means let it not be feigned, let it not be pretended, let it not be hypocritical, let it indeed be genuine and sincere. Then he says, abhor that which is evil and cleave to that which is good. Now, this is a negative and a positive. It is not wrong always to hate. That's what abhor means. There are some things, to be Christ-like, we will hate. Proverbs chapter 6 says there are six things, yea, seven, that the Lord hated. Now, there are some things that deserve our utter contempt. Every false way. But you know there's a world of difference between hating a false way and hating a person, isn't it? You can hate what people do, but you ought to always, like God, have a love for people. Because they're a precious soul. They're the soul. They're precious. They're going to be immortal. They're going to continue to exist. But as you're to hate what is wrong, hold to that which is good. And then he says, and this is brotherly love, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor, preferring one another. Now look how this contrasts with the person who's so heady and high-minded and thinking more highly of himself than he ought to think. Here's a person who recognizes a family relationship toward his brothers and sisters in Christ, and he looks out after the well-being of others and considers them above himself. Not slothful in business. And that's not talking about just a businessman. He's talking about someone who's in the Father's business, if you please. Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 10, it says, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it how? With all thy might. Now, if it's worth doing, and I used to hate hearing this, but Mom and Daddy kept saying it, and it's true whether I did it or not. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. That was right after I hadn't done so well on something, you know. If it's worth doing, do it right. Well, you know that's right. It's sometimes hard to measure up to that, but it is right. You know, I feel so sorry. Now, this is where my sympathy is going to overflow. I feel so sorry for people who don't like what they're doing. Oh.
Don't do nothing about it.
Nothing. Sometimes they can do about it. Sometimes they're not trained to be able to do what they'd like to do. Sometimes they don't have opportunity to do what they're doing. Sometimes they just haven't taken advantage. Sometimes they're just so trifling they don't put forth enough get up and go to do what they want. But a person to do what he wants to do and likes to do, he is one of the most blessed people on earth. Well, I always used to feel sorry for a fellow with whom we worked there in the print company one time. He's talking about, come in, his lips would be dragging the ground every morning. Drag around all day, Right before quitting time, he'd perk up because he'd go home for a while. Come in next day, dang it. What are you so down about? Oh, same old thing. Just come to work. I hate this job. Just come to work. Go through what you have to do. Go home and just plan for the weekend. What an existence. I tell you, I just can't hardly wait till the next day to get to you. I wouldn't swap with a soul on God's earth. I might change a few things, but I sure wouldn't swap. I think that's the reason you can have an optimistic attitude if you like what you're doing, or what you're trying to do anyway. And when you like what you're doing, you can put your whole self into it. You can just, like the engineer said, full throttle. Boy, just let her rip wide open. Here we go. Because it's not work. It's not work to work when you're doing what you like. Cutting grass is not even work to me. Because I like to cut grass. Because that's one of the few things I do, Brother Turner, that I can tell where I've been. You like, okay, I'll keep that in mind next spring. You heard him say it. He likes to cut grass. I'm going to make him the happiest man next spring you ever saw. All right. But now, he says, not sloping a bit. Don't go about your efforts in life in a slothful, slovenly, indifferent way. That's not Christ-like. Christ went after what he did with all of his power. I think he liked what he was doing. Of course, he had a God-given mission. And when you feel like you realize you know you have a purpose, you have a mission, you have a goal, here is something in which you are involved that matters, why, it's not hard to get enthusiastic about it. I don't care whether you're planting trees, selling groceries, digging a ditch, selling insurance, or counting bricks. You don't count them, but you got folks that do. Whatever it is, when you can throw yourself into it, you can be a happy person. Being a Christian, you can be a happy person because you're not slovenly and slothful in what you're doing. Then he says, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. That's the way Christians are supposed to be. Now, rejoicing in hope. We have hope. We have more reason to rejoice than any people on the face of the earth. Patient in tribulation. Steadfast. Stick-to-itiveness. Don't quit. Keep on keeping on, even in the problems. Continuing instant, that means with faithfulness and steadfastly in prayer. We've mentioned before, and we'll not belabor this tonight, but this privilege of prayer that we have, oh, brethren, how we ought to utilize it publicly and privately. Distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. You know, a person that's given to hospitality, that doesn't just mean have somebody over for dinner. It's a good idea if you invite the preacher over sometime. But I mean, hospitality is an attitude as well as an action. It's a consideration of other people. It's a warmth. It's a friendliness. It's an outreaching to other people. You care about other people. You're interested in other people. That's what hospitality is. And then he says, wait till next week and look at verse 14. All of these qualities have to be developed. We're not born with them. And we don't just go and take a pill and get them like that. You grow to develop. But with verse 14, he begins to talk about some qualities, brethren, that are more difficult maybe for some than for others. Maybe more difficult for all of us. Because it begins to deal with those who would, if they could, destroy us.